Okay, so if you spend enough time around ceremonial magicians, particularly ones who are either involved in Thelema or influenced by Thelema, maybe to some degree people coming out of the Golden Dawn systems, you'll hear the Abramelin working get referenced a lot. And I think some of it is just that the idea is really kind of fascinating and neat, that you go and do this long, ongoing magical retreat where you are doing all this magic stuff for months on end until you finally get this uber cool, intense result where you now like know all the stuff you're supposed to know and have like more power and knowledge and magical capability and understand yourself much more fully, and you win. Like that's like what it is. It's about winning. You think that you've won by the time you get it. You get the prize at the bottom of the box. The thing is, well, no, we'll get to what it actually is in a minute. I think there's also kind of still a bit of a buzz from all the Victorian hype surrounding it. I know when I was younger, people talked about the like goofy people talked about the Necronomicon being the text that people would go crazy and die if they tried to translate or tried to use. People who were more serious talked about John Greer was supposed to be doing a translation of it.
Picatrix?
Yes, the Picatrix. That there was no English translation of the Picatrix because it was such a powerful magical book that anytime people tried translating it, they went crazy, or they'd break it up between multiple translators, so no one was translating the whole thing, but their lives would still be ruined. Back during the Victorian era, that was the Abramelin. There were stories that like even just possessing a copy of The Sacred Magic of Abramelin the Mage, that it was such a powerful book that your life would start getting fucked up just by having a copy of it. No. Now the thing is, like, nothing in the book makes sense for that. Like, you're calling on your holy guardian angel to teach you sacred magic, which is supposed to be more true than all of the fake evil magic that other magicians do, and you're supposed to like understand God and the universe and magic so much better because you've done this. Now, why possessing this destroys your life, I have no idea. That just makes no sense at all. It should be just like, almost like the way your more superstitious Kabbalists are with, like, possessing the Zohar as a good luck charm. Like, you would think that that would be how they... If you wear it on your head, all of the magic and knowledge of the Zohar goes into your brain.
You have a very heavy hat.
Yes. What? Well, I was just mentioning earlier I used to sleep with that under my pillow and I had weird dreams. I was like 15 when I slept with the Necronomicon under my pillow. It was not like... Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like I think you get part of it where it's like you want to seem super cool and spooky and powerful, so it's like, oh, I have this dangerous book. We're just possessing it as dangerous. But then, like Stephanie pointed out, there is the other element that, like, being confronted by something that's real or something that's true or something that can actually change things for you can be kind of frightening, and so people avoid that. That's why, I mean, again, for the whole thing of anyone who's been to a handful of classes that I've taught has probably heard me talk about the whole thing where people write books on really silly magical topics because they're afraid to deal with actual magic that's going to change things because they don't want that responsibility. And so a book where the whole point is to take you to this extreme magical level where you are taking on all this responsibility and all this capability for things, it could be potentially terrifying for people, but at the same time pretty fascinating. And I think despite the fact that it has this fascination, it has this draw, and kind of going along with the idea that actually doing this and experiencing this could be kind of like a scary big change, a lot of people recognize that it's a major initiatic benchmark, that it's something that, like, yeah, when you do this, you've really accomplished something in your magical work and really developed yourself, but that doesn't drive people to do it. Like, most people that you meet have not actually done the working, and probably won't actually do the working. it's not something that has become common. It's not something that was common back when Mathers translated it. It's something that a lot of people like as kind of a curiosity. Part of that is that a lot of people think it's insurmountable, that there's just too much work to do it, that you can't continue your life and do this long retreat and remove yourself from stuff. And most people don't have the means to remove themselves from their lives for a long enough period of time to do it. Now, Carrie can attest to the fact that doing a magical retreat is completely doable. You just have to prepare and plan. Was it a month that you went away to do the lunar working? And if you look at Mathers' Abermelin, it says 6 months. If you look at the German Abermelin, it's 18 months. But even in Mathers' Abermelin, only the last 2 months of that is, or in Mathers' Abermelin, only the last 2 months is one where you're actually really removing yourself from doing stuff. The first 4 months, you're still continuing to do most of the normal things you'd be doing in your life while also doing the Abermelin stuff. And I believe in the German one, it works the same way, that it's not even the last 6 months, because it's broken down into thirds the same way that Mathers is. But it's like a portion of that last 6 months, so the last like two or three again, where you're really kind of cloistering yourself and focusing primarily just on the working itself. And in the Abermelin, it actually talks about points in your life in which to begin the work, based on your ability to say like, hey, I don't have a lot of other things that are going to be going on right now, so I can go do this. Like he recommends doing it before you're married. Or if you do it while you're married, either do it in the first year after marriage, because that year is sacred, according to Abraham the Jew. I don't know why. Or do it after your children are grown and out of the house, because then that's one less responsibility that you have. So, I mean, he even kind of acknowledges in the text that, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that you're going to have to deal with, so do it at a time where you're able to actually commit to it, because you probably won't come back to it and finish it if you stop. But you could also look at some of the other variations on it, like Liber 8, which is the AA method, only takes 11 weeks. So you don't have 6 months, because it's basically just looking at that final period that you would be doing in the traditional working, because you've done all the other AA stuff leading up to it, which has prepared you otherwise, so you don't need the full 6 to 12 months of preparation beforehand. You can just do the last 2 or 3 months. My method, while it was several months for the whole thing, the actual final ritual was about 2 months. But I was still able to continue doing other things with it. But I think that's one of the things that prevents people from doing it, is they're like, well, I can't just stop my life for a couple months. In fact, I got a message Thursday night from somebody someone that I keep saying keeps telling me he's kind of come back to the lodge, but doesn't. He said again he's coming back from Richmond, but now he's going to do the Abermelin first. And he was like, well, how did you get around like still like having your job and dealing with all your other responsibilities? And I was like, well, come to the class this weekend and you'll find out. But so I think that's what stops people, because that's the first question everyone asks. Even when I set up mine, I was like, well, how am I going to deal with these other things that I have to do? It's like, I'm still going to be having to go to fencing practices and coach. I'm still going to have to go to work. I'm still going to have to deal with things with my family. I don't want to just tell all my friends, like, no, you can't talk to me for the next couple months. And I think that was part of why I drug my feet with it, because I should have been able to start working on it, like, 3 or 4 years before I did. And I would occasionally start studying things for it, putting materials together, figuring out how I was going to do it. And then I would be like, well, now's not a good time. Or I would pick a day where it was like, okay, this is going to be when I start it, because this is going to time out well for other things that will be going on in my life. And then I would get to that day and be like, oh, I've got this other stuff to worry about. I'm not going to do it now. And I think that even for people who get to the point where they're like, okay, I'm going to try this, that's pretty common. This kind of drag your feet and then eventually just don't do it, or drag your feet and take forever before you do it. But I think most people just don't even get to that point, because they're just like, wow, that's a whole lot of work for, I don't really see what I'm going to get out of it. So in the question of what you're going to get out of it, you kind of have to look at what it is. A lot of times people, when they say the Abramelin working, they're either talking specifically about the working described in the Sacred Magic of Abramelin the Mage, or they're talking about Liber Samech. Sometimes you'll get people who will include the Golden Dawn's Adeptus Minor initiation in it, because that is supposed to have essentially the same type of effect, or at least prepare you for beginning that work. Looking at the Sacred Magic of Abramelin the Mage as an option for explaining what it is a pretty good one, because the ritual is freaking named after that text. Looking at Liber Samech is kind of a misapprehension. Crowley is described as having used Liber Samech for the purpose of achieving knowledge and conversation. Now, if you look at some of his descriptions on what all went into that, he did other things in preparation for this also. Samech was just one of the ritual practices that he was focusing on for it. Additionally, the AA curriculum specifically has a text which outlines how you do this working, and Liber Samech is not that text. Now, when you read the description in Liber 8, it talks about different prayers that you're supposed to do, and it does seem to be kind of implied that Liber Samech is a part of it, but it's not the actual thing itself. So I would say, like, if you're, well, yes, a lot of people will either think the Sacred Magic or they'll think Liber Samech, that you really want to dig a little bit deeper into it as you start thinking about what it is that the ritual is. And for what it is, really the idea is that it's basically full entry into Tiferet. Tiferet being the kind of heart of the body of God, the sun center, the place that represents the seat of the soul and reflects Keter, which is basically the kind of ultimate expression of God within the Tree of Life. Now, Tiferet itself is kind of bidirectional. Most of the things that relate to Tiferet in a traditional sense are things that are twofold or have two natures. And all the spheres kind of are multifaceted, Tiferet is one of the ones that's clearest in having a dual nature. Did you need another pen or something?
Yeah, this one keeps messing up.
There may be one in the bin back there on the main table. If you look at Tiferet specifically, a lot of the correspondences on it in more traditional Jewish correspondences are going to be things where they're dual. And Tiferet is one of the clearest spheres in looking at the experience of it as being one where you have kind of an outer edge to it and an inner edge to it, and the two express different levels of initiation. And part of that has to do with the way in which it relates to Keter. You can almost think of kind of the inner core of Tiferet as being the outer edge of Keter, and the light that Tiferet exudes is kind of the radiance of that shining intense fire that is at the center of its core. So you have the sun and then the actual essence of the sun that creates the sun's light. Or I suppose you have the sun and then the sun's light as the two elements of Tiferet. Now going along with that, the Grade of Adeptus Minor, which relates to entry into Tiferet, has a twofold nature as well. You have the Adeptus Minor within and the Adeptus Minor without. The task of the Adeptus Minor without is simply achieving knowledge and conversation of his Holy Guardian Angel, in which case he then becomes an Adeptus Minor within, because he enters fully into Tiferet at that point. So you're dealing with the idea of becoming completely entwined in this sphere. Now, the general nature of the sphere, I mean, it's described as beauty or splendor, but it relates to balance, which goes in line with this bidirectionality that it has, that you're taking the two different pillars and you're balancing them together. So you have mercy and severity as the two hands of Tiferet. In the creation story, Genesis, Adam sins, God gets pissed off, God kicks Adam and Eve out of the Garden of Eden. Kabbalistically, what's happening there is that initially you have the kingdom, Malchut, and you have the foundation, Yesod, put together, like we talked about yesterday. And so that's Eden, where you have the world and the light of divinity all in one unit. The tree gets fucked up by God getting mad. Basically, you have up above Tiferet, the highest two knowable spheres on the tree before you have the supernals, Gevura, or judgment, and Hesed, mercy. So, mercy and judgment exist in balance initially, and so the tree is able to be in a balanced, ordered fashion. But Adam requires the judgment of God, and so God has to respond with judgment. So instead of having an exchange of judgment and mercy, you have an exchange of purely judgment at that point. And so that raises the power of Gevura up above the power of Hesed. Now God tempers his judgment with mercy. He doesn't simply kill Adam and Eve outright and destroy mankind. He takes away their immortality and makes them live out in the world where eventually they will die. But it's still to the point where it basically misaligns the rest of the tree. And so Tiferet is drawn out of balance, causing everything below Tiferet, because Tiferet, being the sun on the tree, is also the force that anchors everything into its correct position, which is part of how it balances everything. The rest of the lower spheres get pulled out, and because of this, the kingdom falls off from God. And that's the nature of the exile of man. The purpose of Tiferet then, in an initiatic sense, at least in the Jewish Kabbalah, is that you achieve a state where you rebalance the world. You find a balance in yourself so that you are able to balance mercy and judgment within your life, and the way in which you channel those forces out into the rest of the world, as Tiferet is the channel of the higher and the lower. You can look at the Tree of Life almost as if you have two pentagrams that come together, where one is descending all of the higher forces down into the lower, and then the other is expanding those forces out into the material world. Tiferet is the top point of one and the bottom point of the other. So it's the receipt of all of the divine forces and the delivery of those forces into the world. Which again is why you have Tiferet as the marriage of heaven and earth, and also another way in which Tiferet is balancing things. Not only is it balancing mercy and judgment, but it's balancing the creation and the created. So by realigning that balance within yourself, you re-enter the state of Eden, which is part of the nature of adepthood, that you are existing in a state where you're now in close enough communion with the divine that you're able to begin understanding the way in which the divine manifests in the world and the way in which the world itself is divine, returning to that same original state that occurs in Eden. So that's basically what it is that the working is doing for you. Now, this idea that, like, well, when you do the working, it's awesome and you've won, you've got the prize at the bottom of the box, that's all false. The working is just the beginning at that point. Like I said, you've got the two pentagrams locked together, so you've gone through one of them, you still have the whole other one to get through at that point. When you begin that work, you're moving from where you're working on an elemental level to where you're working on a planetary level, and so now you have seven phases to go through instead of just the four that you've already completed. You basically are beginning a new process of unfoldment whereby you correct the way in which the divine forces are moving into the elemental forces by undergoing the kind of subgrades of the Adeptus Minor through the elements. And then you continue the rest of the cycle through the Major Adept and the Exempt Adept, finishing off the planetary cycle. So you come to know your Holy Guardian Angel at this point. Your Holy Guardian Angel comes to you, speaks to you, you experience it in a way that is essentially more vivid than you've ever experienced anything else magically. When I did it, it was so overwhelming that a scrying that I did earlier that morning, I completely just forgot. It was like it was completely wiped out. It was like it didn't happen because it was nothing in comparison to the result of this. Now, the thing with that is just because you have that doesn't mean you know your true will, doesn't mean you're now like uber powerful, doesn't mean you understand your nature or the universe or anything else. It just means now you have the connection to the part of yourself that can tell you all of that and lead you to all of that. So it really is the beginning of the whole process. Everything else is a preparation for the process of becoming a magician and moving towards mastery. Whereas that is the actual step where you're like, okay, I prepared myself for the process, now I'm actually going to begin doing it. Like how we talked about in the Golden Dawn system yesterday. They teach you all these parts of magic, but don't actually teach you to do it until you become an adept. And then they start teaching you actually to do magic. And even now where you have like a lot more magic stuff that's published and available, and like you can learn like a lot of magic things that you can do, a lot of the common things that you're going to learn from studying books or going to classes at magic stores or classes at even with the OTO or with Wiccan groups, wherever you go, it's stuff where you're dealing with a lot of those parts as individual things still, and not necessarily coalescing them all together into a synchronous whole. You're not doing a lot of like the traditional complete magic systems at that point. What this does is it helps you with moving from taking all of those pieces and moving it into this other system where you have a more complete contiguous magical system.
Quick question?
Yes.
You say that when you have the contact with the Holy Guardian Angel, it's just the beginning.
Yes.
What is the goal of that next phase? I mean, what is it that you're working with? You say it's the beginning, but I have this kind of cloudy, misty.
Okay.
See, I don't know what's on the other side there.
The process that you're beginning there is basically continuing the conversation. So you start talking to your angel, you start getting communication from your angel, which you should have before you do this anyway. You could be like some people who don't have holy guardian angels. They're just awesome magicians already, like Carrie. And then the holy guardian angel is an illusion. It's a way of comprehending a piece of yourself. It can be a very useful illusion. Part of the process is getting rid of the illusion. But the other element of it is that now, instead of dealing necessarily with a person that is guiding you and teaching you things, you're dealing with the piece of you that's God guiding you and teaching you things. And so you're deepening that relationship. Like, you spark the relationship in a way in which the communication is more thorough, and then you continue the communication until you finish that education up to the point of mastery. In doing that, as a Dominus Luminous, you go through and you collect together all of the parts that you learned in the previous grades, and you work them into something where you understand them as a whole. As an adept, you work on mastering using them and incorporating them into your being in a way in which all of the various forces that you interact with through those are now kind of subdued and incorporated into your being as well. So you're activating each part of the universe that's part of your soul until you have the complete view of the universe built into yourself in a way that you fully understand and are able to use. Once you do that, then you're able to move into that final step of mastery where you now have everything kind of built into you and you kind of are able to recognize everything, so you can move past the concept of separation from it, where you're able to recognize that these are all part of you, you're a part of all of them, and there's no divide between you and God. And that's where you move into the phase of being a master and no longer an adept.
Are you saying that, trying to visualize as what the result of this is that, you know, you get early on in your magical career, you get an inventory of the various magical areas of study and mm-hmm. the magical powers. somewhat similar to Patanjali's yoga, and he says the siddhis or yogic powers are the following: clairvoyance, clairaudience, levitation, etc. Are you saying that when you get that contact with the holy guardian angel, you'll either be at a point that you've mastered these individual siddhis or psychic or occult powers, and then you then kind of weave them into a unified whole, kind of like a decathlon of psychic abilities?
In a sense, yes. The like all of the skills and concepts that you're dealing with, you're moving those in, not necessarily all the powers that come from them. Because you could just naturally be really bad at clairvoyance. Like some people are just not able to do that. You don't necessarily have to become clairvoyant in order to become an adept. Now, the skills that you would use in using clairvoyance and the forces that go into play in developing that, you're mastering those skill sets and those forces, not necessarily that particular power. Like the power that comes from them may manifest in you in some other way.
So it's almost like a theosophical concept of getting an idea of what is the perfect man with the, or woman, and the all of the faculties that go with it, and those are somewhat activated, kind of like a superhero archetype.
Yes.
Okay.
And, or it could be a supervillain archetype if you become a black brother and decide you don't want to be part of God, you just want to live forever and make other people
like
not magic.
An ego trip.
Yes. I still want to meet one. Fight them. But so there are a whole bunch of different ways you can accomplish this. Like I mentioned yesterday with Greta Montesabegni, it talks about the AA grade structure, and then it's like you don't have to do any of that. You can just go do whatever it is that you do and then become an adept. But even once you get through all the preparation, there's still a lot of methods for accomplishing that. Did the Merkava class earlier this past year, which talks about a lot of the early Jewish mystical methods that accomplish a lot of the same goals, where you call upon an angel, the angel takes you to the heavens and teaches you things, and once you learn enough things from moving through the heavens, you're able to enter the divine palace and go through all of the palaces until you have the final vision of God, which is pretty similar to crossing the abyss. You have the method of Abraham the Jew, which is what's described in The Sacred Magic of Avermaet and the Mage, where you basically go through, you purify yourself for 3 days by fasting and confessing and covering yourself in ash. And then once you've done that, you begin the actual work, whereby over time you start slowly pulling yourself out of different things that you would be doing in life normally. Making sure you're not doing impure things that are going to take you away from the work, reading the Psalms, meditating on the scriptures, and praying and offering incense and to your angel every day until it finally comes for you. And then once you do that, you subdue the four demon princes and go through the demonic kingdoms and make them your servants. Then
four
you,
nine princes?
The four demonic princes.
Four
and then
demonic.
Then you have the method of the AA, which, like we said, is not just Liber Samech by itself, but is Liber 8, which is something Crowley received in scrying the aethers when he was going through the aethers, which are like the heavens. He, in the 8th aether, he had a description of how to set up a temple and what type of ritual practices to do in order to achieve knowledge and conversation with the Holy Guardian Angel. Now, most of Liber 8 goes through setting up all the materials and how the temple should look. And if you have the space and the resources to actually build a temple described in Liber 8, that's pretty awesome. But I would say for the most part, you're just going to use that for inspiration. It's like he goes through how to set up your flooring, how to have these implements made of gold, and like just all this craziness. But it's a pretty good text in terms of giving you an example of like what types of things may be useful for you in setting it up. One thing that I really like from his version is the use of the lamp and having the lamp in the temple, because the lamp becomes a convenient symbol of the light that you're seeking after. You can also just develop your own method, which is probably the best way to do it, is to start focusing more on working with your angel and looking for inspiration from your angel and how to come into closer contact. Studying other methods like Crowley's method, studying the method of Abraham the Jew, and looking at the Merkabah, looking at other magical systems and seeing how they work. And then from there, seeing what it is that speaks to you, what you're able to pull out, what seems like nonsense, what you want to throw away, and putting something together. I would say the key things that you want to incorporate would be preparing yourself in your location, which is incorporated both into the sacred magic and into the Liberate method. So you go through and you do all the things to get yourself ready, do things to kind of purify yourself, to teach you the things that you need to know before you do it. You also go through, you pick a place where you can do it, set up all the tools that you're going to need, make sure you have everything so you don't start it and then are like, whoa, I need to run around frantically and find this or find that because I'm not going to be able to finish. Then having your daily prayers and reflections, which again is used in both the two big methods. In doing the sacred magic, you would study mostly scripture from the Judeo-Christian structure of things. Doing more of a Liber 8 method, you might study more Thelemic scripture and study the holy books. There are some of them that relate specifically to things connected to this, which are good to study during that time. But you could also find some of the Psalms, or Song of Songs is entirely about this process. It's basically God's love affair with Israel retold as a story of a sexual affair. So that's another good one that you could study and reflect upon in that. Coming up with prayers and magical practices and ritual practices that are going to connect you to your angel and draw that force in more fully into your life. One big thing that's not really present in either that I think is like the most important, I kind of mentioned this yesterday, is coming up with tasks that you should accomplish during the time that you're working on this. Like things that you actually need to change in your life, things that you need to fix in yourself, things that you need to better yourself with in order to make yourself ready to be the person that you need to be. The obvious part is invocation of your angel. You need to have some method for invoking it and telling it to come to you and teach you shit. And again, that's in there with both. Abstinence and fasting. Abraham the Jew makes a big deal out of those. Crowley doesn't really talk about it too much in Liber 8. He has other places where he talks about abstinence, other places where he talks about yogic disciplines, and fasting comes into play with some of that. And some of it's even done in a way where you could derive the realization that it falls in line with what you're doing here and can be useful. But he doesn't quite come out and say, to my recollection, you should be abstinent for this period of time while doing this, or you should fast for this part of the day. So as far as how I actually went through building my method, you've got all your kind of pre-work stuff. Like basically, like I said, for mine, the final method was 8 weeks long because 8 relates to Hadith, which relates to the soul, and so I thought that seemed appropriate. But before I actually started, I started a couple months before that with preparing stuff for it. One of the big things that I realized was kind of out of balance in my life was that like I put on a lot of weight since college, so I started dieting and exercising pretty intensely. I realized that while a lot of my life and time was taken up with fencing, I hadn't been progressing in it too much. So I started training much more actively and set a goal for myself to perform at a certain level at a tournament before the end of the working, and then did so. Reevaluated a lot of stuff with job plans and things like that. Got all of that in order. And basically it's like you just look at the things in your life that are important to you and the things that affect you majorly and see where you are with those things and kind of analyze how to make them better. Setting up the equipment in the temple. I took an area of my room. I live in a basement, so I have a pretty large living space for myself. And I took a section of it and kind of cordoned that off as being my temple space. Cleared out all the stuff that I had stored there, put together what I was going to use for my altar, and then started designing all of the tools that I was going to use for it. Made my lamp, found a way to hang the lamp from the ceiling, made my altar cloth with the appropriate symbols on it that I wanted, obtained the tools that I was going to use for it, obtained the type of sensor that I wanted, created a black mirror for the purpose of conjuring the demonic princes, like all of the various different things. Actually made a carpet out of sheet and felt, so that I would have the black and white countercharged flooring for the space. So that I found to be a really important preparatory aspect of it, because it takes the idea that you're doing this and cements it into your physical life, where you're actually doing things specifically to create the process for yourself. It's not just something where you're thinking like, oh, this would be cool, I'm going to think about doing this, and let me go buy a bunch of stuff for it so I don't have to put in like real effort or work. Like, it makes you actually work for what you're doing if you're building all the stuff that you're going to use for it, or even not necessarily all of the stuff, but you're actually like working to get things. Ironically, one of the things that was the most involved in obtaining was one where I primarily did purchase it and then have the engraving done on it. But it took a while to figure out where to get the thing and where to get it engraved with the symbol that I needed. In my case, one of the things that I kind of looked at was the dates for doing things, because I like picking nice dates for stuff. I don't like getting into the whole, like, oh, I need these astronomical occurrences in place for me to do this. I began the prayer and fasting on Ash Wednesday, and then the final day of the working was April 18th, so it was 418, and the day leading into the final day was the day of the tournament that I set for my goal task. There were a few other things in the dates involved. I also scheduled it so it would overlap with my taking the fourth PI initiation, and a few other things that I had going on in there. And I think I made sure to schedule myself to celebrate the Mass on 418 that year too. So then as far as fasting goes, the first 3 days before actually engaging in the final leg of the ritual, I engaged in fasting, and kind of doing a lot of sort of purification type things. In The Sacred Magic, Abraham the Jew talks about fasting for 3 days and writing out a confession where you confess your entire life. And then you spend the 3 days making the confession. And then once you're done, you burn it and you like wear the ash from it. So what I did in order to interpret that, rather than going through and looking at sins that I had committed, because that seemed irrelevant, I went through and looked at things that were failures in my life and things that I needed to correct in myself in order to be more in line with what my true will was and more in line with being an accomplished magician and doing the things that I needed to do in life, and really deeply analyzed that for several pages, and like kind of looking at each area of life and looking at all the problems in that area. And if you do it honestly and really reflect on it, it's actually a really good exercise and really good task to go through. The thing is, if you're going to keep doing it over and over again during that 3-day period, you don't want to keep your initial copy and keep just reading it off, because then it becomes kind of meaningless. It's like the first time you do confess from the copy you write out. Then after that, go through whatever you're kind of inspired to each time. The way that Libra 8 sets things up, you pray 4 times a day. So in the preparation for things, I set up a 4-time for the confession, and then had like prayers and rituals that went along with the confessing during those times. Then burned the confession with an old cake of light that I had from a previous time of deciding to try to attempt the ritual, and then wore the ash from that. Kind of a weird thing while burning the ash. It was like 2 or 3 in the morning, and this was around the time where we had the double blizzards. So there was like several feet of snow on the ground. And I'm outside with a metal bowl trying to make a cake of light and a piece of paper burn which is incredibly difficult because cakes of light don't really burn. And like pouring alcohol onto it to like try to get it to burn. Now I live kind of on the outer edge of Catonsville, so I'm not in near where the park is, where there's all the woods, so usually there's not a lot of deer or fox or any wild animals near my house, because I live closer to the edge that where you're getting in towards the city. And so I'm standing outside, like, doing, like, the like, magical prayers and all, and trying to, like, burn this stuff, and, like, figuring, like, well, it's 2, 3 in the morning, no one's going to be out here and notice, so I'm fine, no one's going to come bother me. And, like, I've got it sitting on, like, a pile of snow to keep the bowl from getting too hot so I can, like, handle it and all. And I just keep hearing this rustling and this moving around, like, somebody's, like, checking these out. I'm like, shit, there's somebody out there. And then I'm like, well, I need to keep doing this. I can't, like, run inside. And then all of a sudden a fox jumps up over a snowbank that's, like, on top of a car. And so the fox is up on top of the snow on top of the roof of this car. And I'm like, holy shit. One, how did the fox get up there? And two, why the fuck is there a fox? And so then, like, the fox, like, runs out across, like, where I'm, like, doing this burning, and then, like, runs down the street. And, like, I'd never seen a fox in my neighborhood before. It was just like, that's gotta mean something, but I have no idea what it means. Those of you who are friends with me on Facebook may have seen that I posted about having a weird thing with a bee on my altar during this time too, where a bee crawled down the cross on the altar and then nestled itself inside of my ring. And like it kind of crawled along each edge of the ring first and then climbed inside the ring and kind of curled up like it was going to go to sleep in it. And the... I never heard that. Like, what I was kind of looking at was how, since they make honey, honey relates to the sun and Apollo, that, like, that kind of was fitting, but sort of combining the celerity and the death is even more fitting.
Apollo has some very interesting underworld aspects.
Yes. So, like, but those were just kind of, like, weird little things that happened while doing that. Part of the kind of purification thing was to meditate and scry the death card routinely, to drink salt water, to bathe in water with hyssop oil in it, and recite purification prayers while doing that each night. Going through and doing the lesser banishing ritual, the pentagram and the hexagram and the star ruby and the star sapphire daily, which initially I thought I would be doing through the whole working, but doing it during the purification, there was this like intense sense of like, no, you're doing this to kind of say goodbye to these rituals, and you're only going to use them when necessary now. So like then the actual working began. Started it off with making new first generation cakes of light. So completing the abstinence period with conjuring new wheat to copulate with new wheat into the cakes. Then did kind of like a modified solo mass to kick everything off. Doing resh every day. Started out where the daily prayers were about 5 minutes each time during the day. Eventually built up to where it was about 45 minutes to an hour each time doing them. Adding in all sorts of different prayers over time, like as I was getting deeper and deeper into it. Using the prayer of St. Francis was a big one that was added early on. The word of the god John from the ship. The Bornless Invocation. I created a series of planetary prayers where there was one for the planet in each element, and you had to do the prayer according to the number of the planet Kabbalistically and do them, like add a new prayer each day and do all of the prayers so that by the time you were at the end, you had all 28 prayers being said at once with all of the Saturn prayers being repeated 3 times, the Jupiter prayers being repeated 4 times, Mars 5 times, solar prayer 6 times, Venus prayer 7 times, Mercury prayer 8 times, Luna prayer 9 times. So that alone, by the time you got to the end, took a couple hours to do. Going through just praying the solar hierarchy and meditating on the way in which the sun manifests in each of the different elemental levels, that ended up being a pretty big impacting one as I got deeper and deeper into doing that one. And then continuing the oil bath with abramelin oil instead of hyssop oil, and reciting parts of the mass during that. So that's basically how I did it. You could come up with anything that speaks to you. If you're really into chaos magic, you could go read Alice in Wonderland and figure out how the caterpillar is your holy guardian angel, I guess. But that just kind of gives you an idea of a structure that you can use, things that you can draw on for inspiration in it. If some particular system of mysticism speaks to you really well, then you would use prayers and scriptures from that system of mysticism. You could completely write all of your own prayers for it. I would say incorporating the Bornless Invocation or Liber Samech, whether it initially speaks to you a lot or not, is probably good anyway. That's one of the few invocations that I've ever encountered where, even if you're not trying to really magically do the invocation and invoke stuff, just reading through it seems to have a pretty solid effect. That and the Enochian calls. But Crowley was very adamant about that one being a fairly key thing to use in invoking your angel. And that's pretty much it for the process. I mean, if you actually look at the sacred magic, it's only about 2 chapters of the text that actually deals with the actual retreat. And they're short chapters. Most of it deals with him kind of talking to his son about the conditions for doing it, talking about the life that he led leading up to it. And then the rest of the book is largely the squares for calling the demons to do things for you. Crowley's text on how to do it is just a couple pages long. So it's pretty much left to you to figure out how exactly you would be doing the ritual and when exactly you would be doing it. If you look at the sacred magic, it talks a little bit about what days to start it on. Crowley talks about what days to create some of your equipment and the days in which to actually do it. But there's no reason that you have to stick to those days. In my case, I found days that seemed significant for me and seemed to fit well with what it was that I was going to be doing. Everybody's going to have their own time frames where that all works out. So, are there any questions on any of that?
How much of a time commitment? I mean, I know, I guess for most of it, you were still going on with your daily life and mm-hmm. things like that, but once you get to the core part of it towards the end, I mean, how much?
I would do the afternoon prayers during my lunch break, and eventually got to the point where it took up the entire lunch break. The evening prayers, if I was going home in the evening, I would do them when I got home. If I was coaching or going somewhere else in the evening, I would do them in the car on the ride home, which was distracting sometimes. But you find ways where you can work it all in, and I think that that's the thing is that people miss with it, is that while in sacred magic it talks about cloistering yourself and removing yourself, the whole idea is that you're bringing heaven and earth together in yourself at this point. You're changing your life so that your life is fitting in with what your angel is directing you to do, but you're still living your life. And so you can't do that by completely removing yourself from it.
All right, so you didn't actually take a significant amount of time off the work.
No.
Reading a lot of these older texts, it's you almost have to be, independently wealthy. So to buy the materials, to devote the time to it.
Yeah, it was basically the final 2 days where the majority of it was spent in doing stuff for the working that I had to take off. But man, most of the rest of the time didn't really have to. Yes?
I think there was a book out that kind of was supposed to describe the diary of somebody doing the abramelin working. Are you familiar with that?
There was 20th century or 21st century magus or something like that, or 21st century magician by James Augustus Newcomb or Jason Augustus Newcomb, which I've never read. I know a couple people who liked it a lot, a couple people who really hated it, so I don't know if it's good or not. There is another one that I've heard of.
I think that was out around the 1980s.
Yeah,
so.
I was going to say there is another one that was a diary. I have never actually seen it. My mentor told me about it when I was preparing for the ritual, but his response to it was that it seemed like a lot of groveling and unnecessary humbling of the self, the way that the guy did it. Like, he was going, like, very old school, like, God is going to destroy me, so I have to, like, get down on the ground and beg for forgiveness so that my angel will come to me. But that could have just been his interpretation of it. I haven't actually read the book myself, so I don't know what it was like.
I think I read it about 20 years ago, and the problem was, he then said, and then I had a conversation with my holy guardian and angel, but I'm not going to tell you that because it was all sacred.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, he's got this buildup, and then you're waiting for the experience, and he doesn't tell you what the experience really was, other than it was just simply phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which led me to believe that's bogus bull.
Yeah, and, well, I mean, like, even the way that I described it just now, I described everything in how you do it. I didn't say what happened when I finished, because that really is kind of between you and your angel. So, like, I'll say it was intense, but the actual, like, imagery and all. I mean, I would say a lot of it would be imagery that probably is, like, what specifically would speak to me, but a lot of it was also imagery that I was not expecting, but my mentor said lined up with a lot of the imagery that he experienced when he did it. So maybe there is some consistency, but maybe that's also just because I was taught by him for several years, and so...
Going through it, I mean, I guess you just continue on with the process until it actually happens. I mean, obviously, I guess it could happen at any time.
Well,
or it could take longer than you expected.
That was kind of one thing that I thought doing it. I was like, well, what happens if I'm not at the end? And I've just gotten to the point where it's like I've built up such a head of force that it pushes me over the edge of it. Or what happens if I haven't correctly built up such an amount of force that it pushes me over the end by the time I get to the end? Do you just keep going, or have you just failed? And, like, it seemed like it ended up working. So, like, I guess if you're doing it and earnestly, like, really immersing yourself in it completely, then you're going to get it when you get to the final point. But,
I mean, did you say, okay, I'm going to do this for 8 weeks or whatever, and then see what happens at the end of the 8 weeks?
Yeah, I had it timed out, like, to the day, and it was like and then I did consider that if it didn't work, then I would go ahead and try to rework my plan for a couple more weeks, and try it out at the 11-week time frame that Crowley describes. And I was like, and if that doesn't work, then maybe I'll go back to the drawing board completely and try the whole 18 months. But, like, so.
Also, along the lines of what you're saying, is I don't think it's like necessarily that you're doing the same thing every day, and then on that day it magically happens.
Yeah, the last day you do.
Yeah,
the final day, there's a lot more stuff. Like,
right.
The final day was like several hours of just, like, meditation and ritual and prayer all together, where it was like everything that I had been doing was compressed into that time, along with a bunch of additional things that I hadn't been doing prior to that, and then specifically, like, the final invocation of the angel occurs at that point. Like, you don't, like, you do things that are drawing the angel to you and to pay attention to you the whole time you're doing it, but you don't do your actual invocation until the final morning when you go to do it. Yes.
This seems to me similar to, let's say, shamanistic contacts with various spirits of power animals, teachers, divine beings, etc. I assume then that this is probably in that same genre of how do you make contact with the interior world and the superior beings that will guide you through both your own personal spiritual development as well as giving you the information. information necessary to how do you handle your regular daily life.
Hmm.
Does that sound right to you?
Yeah. Like the, I mean, the things that you should get from it should be things that not only would you apply to magic specifically, but you'd be able to apply to everything else you're doing. You should understand, the lessons you get would be ones where you understand yourself more fully and how you're supposed to be living in the world, so that's going to affect everything you're doing.
And as you said, this is just kind of a new phase. It's not that
right,
somehow everything, you get to be all happy and everything becomes wonderful.
Right. It's just the beginning of other work. In fact, a lot of what I get from my angel now is, stop being a lazy bastard and do more work, I'm going to kill you. Say there'd be no real official like position on that I've ever heard. Like a lot of the treatment within the OTO tends to be when you feel you're ready to go do stuff that you're doing is your own personal magical work. It's your own personal magical work, so you go do it. No one's going to come in and tell you this is how you have to do this or this is when you should be doing that. Now, there, like I mentioned yesterday, there's a ninth degree that once told me that KEW is the point where, if that's going to happen naturally from the OTO system, then that's the point where it's going to happen. That doesn't mean that you have to wait till that point to begin doing that work. If you feel that you're ready from other work that you've done at some other point, or if some other work that you've done has communicated things to you where it's like, yeah, this is the time to do that, then that's the time to do it. I mean, usually my advice to people is, like, try to map yourself onto the Golden Dawn or the AA structure and see where you fit on that and judge it based on that. But for some people, that structure just doesn't speak to them, so they won't.
Like you said, this is, like, something that one would normally do if you had this minor level.
Right, it's
and
the...
And there, of course, there's the four grades below that, or five if one is the information before you get up to that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that work that's done in those grades and it should be something that one needs to prepare themselves with before.
Yeah, I mean, that's the idea, is that the work that you would be doing there leads you to being prepared for this. Now, if you do the whole 18-month cycle, then you probably don't necessarily need any other work. Anyone who's familiar with Rufus Opus's blog, his whole big thing is, like, start with the Abramelin working and do that, and then go do everything else. Now, frequently when he and I talk, it's like, well, you know, Rufus, if you did other magic first, you'd know how to do this thing that you're dealing with right now. But, like, most people who I see just rush into it without any preparation fail. He's, like, the weird example of shining success without doing a bunch of other stuff first.
Perhaps he was already an adeptus minor.
That could be. He had done other periods of doing like magical and ritual work in his life, and had been through a bunch of other like religious experiences and different types of religions before that. But the whole other, the one thing that my mentor always says is, if you were a master of the temple and you die, then in your next life you're still a master of the temple. You just don't remember, and so all your work before, until that point, is just getting back to what you already are and realizing it. So a lot of that work becomes easier and moves through faster. Mm-hmm. I suppose the same could be true of an Adeptus Minor. But.
I still think it would be annoying to come back and not remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. Damn it,
nice.
I know the shit. Why don't I remember?
It would be nice to come back and remember everything you've known in your prior lives.
Everything that was good, anyway.
Yeah.
It's good if you have the calling card for the Akashic Record Library.
Yeah.
There it is.
The only thing I remember from my prior life is just doing a lot of stupid things that don't make me
So, any other questions? Or? Okay.
I have a recircle back on something during the work, during the different work. The thing that you want to work from, for example, say someone's overweight, and I say, you know what, this is it, I've struggled much of my life with my weight problems.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, here's the drama of the weight problem, like we were talking about, those that keep you, or those things that keep you from pursuing your will.
Mm-hmm.
Like persons X, Y, and Z who bring over, you know, all the things you're not supposed to eat. Or another way to do it is to struggle with alcohol. All the people that come over and make in, oh yes, but we've got to come to this party and stuff like that. Oh, it's like, oh, I forgot to say, here, yeah, well, oh, you can just have this one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can just have this, okay. Or the other person recognizing that, no. It's like, no, you're just, what you're giving me is a glass of poison.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that. So, but don't you want, but you're upsetting them if you say that, no. I understand where they're coming from. I don't waste energy getting mad at them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get upset. You know, it's basically like being upset at a rattlesnake for, you know, coming back trying to bait you. It's like, why should you be mad at the rattlesnake? It's only being the rattlesnake.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so you're like, you're working that particular issue,
mm-hmm.
and working the what you need to do to go through the tasks to overcome those, and to work the magic to offset those activities that want to pull you to the side or the rock. In the overweight situation, those people that come in, whatever, or, oh, you don't need to exercise, oh, this is okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, no, you need to exercise, this is how. Or, you know, this is it. If you see it as a real thing, or is it a thing that it's within your okay, this is all right. The ease may be within. The ease is not necessarily in the individual. Say, yeah, blow that off, it's to do this. It's to be the individual. The structure, the dedication to the work, to achieve the goal of maintaining the weight at
mm-hmm.
a certain size. Or
it all becomes a development of the will, right?
Yeah.
That you're applying willpower to accomplish something, and therefore you're training yourself to be able to apply your will once you know what your true will is.
Because yeah. There's folks in the area with addictions that, well, it's always there. You're never going to really overcome it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's one way of existence.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, which is that. The dance, this is a, you know, it's like I'm dancing with death.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always dancing with it. I'm not saying that it's like, oh, it's, I'm enamored with it, but I'm dancing. I know that this is the partner that I will always have in the dance.
Mm-hmm.
The partner is, you know, whatever it is. This is the monkey on the back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the side. That's what is always there. Whereas in the case of you're working, you're doing something that you can overcome. Maybe another better way of it is horrible, horrible claustrophobia or agoraphobia.
Mm-hmm.
Or really agoraphobia, where the vigil that you're going to work on is that open spaces drive you crazy. And you know you have to take, somebody's told you, you know what, your new job is not going to be in New York City. Guess where it's going to be? I don't know. Oh, I'm sorry. It's going to be in Wichita, Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. You go out to the wide open spaces, I can't deal with that. Well, now you got to work on things so you can go out there and
mm-hmm.
freak out. So you work that so you don't want to.
Yes.
In looking at the Abramelin working, I guess you saw there was a whole bunch of stuff there, a whole bunch of ritual practices, etc.
Mm-hmm.
In looking at some of the reviews on Amazon for Lewuski's Kabbalistic Handbook, he talks about taking a look at a ritual from an overview viewpoint in doing your analysis of it so that you understand the pieces of it.
Mm-hmm.
Did you, in starting this, say, have some governing ideas or principles of, gee, this is a whole lot of material, a whole lot of practices, how do I get a handle on it?
Well, like, what I basically did was I had read the Mathers version a while before. And then I went through and read the new translation and kind of pulled out from it the things that I thought were useful and the things that seemed to speak to me. I had studied Crowley's method a couple of times, then also read some of his other writings in Confessions and in I think in book four there's some stuff also that talks about his view on doing it, and then went through doing a lot of the preparation for the Merkava class, and kind of reviewing a lot of my knowledge regarding that, and sort of from all of those things pulled out all the things that stood out and seemed to make sense for it. So a lot of it was kind of reviewing a whole lot of different parts from different things and saying, okay, these parts all seem to go together.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You said that there was a new translation?
Yeah, it came out probably like 4 or 5 years ago now. I think Dane, D-E-H-N, is the translator, or he wrote the introduction. It's just called Abramelin.
Is that much different than Matter's version?
Yeah, it's a whole different manuscript that they used.
Oh, okay.
So.
Different ideas, not just...
The ideas are basically the same, but like the squares are more complete. There's more squares. The time frame is different. Some of the description of things are different. There's like chapters in that one that aren't in the Mathers one. I don't think it's anything where it's going to change your basic understanding of it, but you might find a few things that are interesting.
They found a second manuscript.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a German manuscript.
Okay. Matters in his translation. Alluded that he didn't know of any other translation than the one that he
translated
at that time.
This other one's pretty recent, right?
Yeah, I think that they knew that the German one existed back then. There was just no translation of it. And I mean, back then, to say, like, I've done the only translation of this mega important book, that's just what people did.
Was the German
buy their books?
Was the German translation 19th century German or German contemporary with the author of the book?
I'm not sure. There's like in the introduction, there's a whole thing about how they determined who Abraham the Jew was, and so it was probably a manuscript that was written in the style of German from the time of Abraham the Jew. But I have not looked at the German manuscript, so.
It's like they have folks that are not German that have written did a translation for translation of Wagnerian opera, and they preferred it to the regular German translation of the opera. This individual was able to get into the heart of the opera more.